No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Good evening and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about and affect the lives of all of us. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you. So please call in and be part of the conversation by calling 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype your comments and questions to BBSRADIO and the number 1. Tonight we have no guest, it's just Maria and I, woohoo! But we're going to be talking about some interesting stuff, genetically modified organisms. I mean, just saying the word scares me, but first, the phrase scares me, but first, let's just talk a little bit about what's going on here in Washington. Welcome, by the way, Maria.
Thank
Maria
you,
was out gambling in Las Vegas last week. Did you win anything?
Do you know, I am not a gambler, and I never have been. I want something for my money. I don't get the rush, and I know that those places exist because most people do lose. But I actually gambled $20 twice, which is the most I've ever spent in my entire life. Literally.
And well, I agree with you. And my brother used to be stationed at Nellis Air Force Base, which is right there in Las Vegas. And I would go out and see him. And back in the day, this probably isn't as true anymore, but 35 years ago, everything in Las Vegas was pretty cheap if you didn't gamble. The food was good and inexpensive, yep. And the shows were cool. And you know, and recently we had somebody from our office was Miss DC, and we all went to Atlantic City to see her compete. And again, things in Atlantic City were very inexpensive. I couldn't believe it. Valet parking was like $5 a night, and, mm-hmm. and hotel rooms were like $50 in a really nice hotel. So,
but that's not the case in Vegas anymore. It's tickets are like on the Broadway. Costs in terms of the prices for shows. We saw Billy Idol, which was his last night on Saturday night. And we saw Lionel Richie. That was Sunday night at 8 o'clock, and they're hard to get. And my friends somehow know how to navigate things. They got us Lionel Richie tickets for $59, and they're like $219.
Right. So, I know, it's killer.
But but we went out to eat, and my meal was $70. I mean, there's no. Even the buffet at the Bellagio we did Sunday for brunch, that was like $49. So it's not what it used to be for, I don't know what, I guess it was just get people through the door and then they'll drop money on the tables was the mentality. Right. But now people are coming for an experience.
Right. And it's, they have stuff for the kids. They have mm-hmm. all sorts of things that, you know, they didn't have back in those days. It was all about gambling, but it was also all about, you know, the $5 all-you-could-eat brunch and, you know, other things like that. And I'm the same way you are. I've never won anything in my life. I mean, I go in and I like to gamble a little bit, so I'll take $50 or $100, and when I've lost it, I'm done. Because I know, you know, there's no big thrill in it for me. But
some people get that adrenaline rush, like it's a high. That, you know, maybe this time kind of thing. To me, I'd rather go to a 2-drink minimum show or pay to see a performer and not pay to have that experience. I see, well, I was, the father of my children is a gambling addict, so I've seen that how it can destroy lives. And literally, he lost our mortgage on the table. You know, I mean, it was bad, what? Bad, bad. And again, that's, you know, not everybody. Most people, I think, can be moderate. But I saw that happen firsthand, and it was like, I don't get it at all that you could be that irresponsible when you've got a wife and four children, you know. No.
Well, you know, it's amazing. And I, like I say, I've never had it either, but I've seen it in other people. I used to work with a couple of guys that sent me to the track every day to place bets for them. And I don't think these guys ever won a dime. But also I helped train Native Americans that wanted to run for public office through different training camps. And we had them at casinos. And one of the most insidious things I think I've ever seen is at one of those casinos, they had a big glass room. And inside the room were video games that mimicked the, you know, slots and other stuff for kids. There was no money. There was no money exchanging hands.
Oh, no.
But, so it was okay, I guess, legally. But there, you know, mommy could be spending the mortgage money on the machine, and they're watching her kid in the next room through this big plate glass window. The whole room was made out of glass, watching them do the same thing and mimic their behavior. And I just thought to myself, that's terrible.
Well, and guess what they're doing? They're grooming the next generation.
Exactly. And you know what? If you've got a gambling problem, you know, your kids may be genetically predisposed to it to begin with, and then you're training them on exactly how to do it. And
that is correct.
And I just thought that was the craziest thing I've ever seen. But
You know what? It follows psychologically. There's something called intermittent reinforcement, which means that you don't always get a payoff. So if you have lab rats who push a lever and they get water, they drink it till they're sated. If they push a lever and they get sugar water, they drink it until they're done. If every fifth pull or every tenth pull or every ninth pull, whatever, it's random, is sugar water, they spend their entire day and life pulling on that lever waiting for the sugar.
Right.
So they can't be moderate because it's intermittent. They don't know when they're going to get it, and maybe this time, maybe this time, maybe this time.
Well, and you know, this is one of the ways that they've lost me in casinos, is that one of the few things I did like to do was play the slots, but you don't even get to pull the arm anymore.
It's
all electronic. It takes me 20 minutes to figure out how the machine even works. And when I went to Atlantic City, I took $5. I went over to the slot machine. I put it in. I hit the button. It was the big payoff slot machine, you know, one in a billion chances of winning. And when I didn't win, that was it. I said, yep, you know, I'm done.
But before and that's what I spent my money on. And they say if you don't put in the maximum, whichever it is, 3 coins, 5 coins, you know, not coins, but credits, then you don't get the progressive. And I was only playing at that because what the heck, if I'm going to win, I might as well win big, right, or go home. And so I was putting in, I don't know, 15 a time or something. Well, that goes fast when you put in 20 bucks.
Yeah, and you know what? I think it goes even faster when you stick a card in the machine and you're really not pulling the cash out of your pocket and seeing it anymore and putting, you know what I mean? It's just like, and all of a sudden you look at it and you go, what? that's never had a great allure for me, but I mean, my God, look at these places they build. Obviously they make a ton of money. Even the Indian casinos, if they're in a good place, I think the one we played in California, Southern California, is the one which has the room in it that I was talking about.
Oh, really?
Because that's outside of Los Angeles. Yeah.
There's a Chumash casino that folks go to that's driving distance from where I live. And I hear they even have a smoking section so smokers can gamble. And they've got great entertainment and everything else. I've never been, so I can't speak to it personally. But
this place had it all. Had the Bengals were playing in the bar.
There you go.
You know, and they also had a food court. So you know what I mean? You could go in and spend, like you did, $75 on a steak dinner, or you could go to McDonald's. I mean, they had all their bases covered. And I wish I could remember the name of it, but it's outside of L.A. And, though, you know, they get a lot of people because you can drive from Los Angeles.
Exactly.
So exactly. It's a big deal. And I got on the elevator. I'll tell you, this is a true story. I got on the elevator one night. We were running a conference out there, and this I would say middle-aged Asian woman got on, and I said to her, how are you, or, you know, something to that effect. And she goes, well, I've had better days. And I said, You didn't do too well? And she said, I just dropped $40,000. Well, I thought to myself, if I dropped $40,000, I wouldn't be able to go home. I wouldn't be able to go home and tell my wife I had dropped $40,000.
I couldn't utter the words.
Yeah. Man, I was just amazed. And she said it so casually, like, yeah, some days you win, some days you lose. Well, speaking of winning and losing,
okay,
there's
tell
some
us.
Stuff going on here in Washington right now. And one of them is that the people of the District of Columbia, as you know, don't have the right to a representation in Congress. But worse than that, they don't even have the right to home rule. Congress actually runs the city. So we passed a referendum a couple of years back by 82%, allowing us to spend our own money in the District of Columbia. And I, along with several other people, thought it was a foolhardy move because we know Congress can do whatever it wants. But we took it up there. It sat in Congress for the requisite layover period. And if you folks out there don't know what the layover period is, every law that's passed in the District of Columbia has to sit for 30 or 60 legislative days before Congress, before it can become a law. And it did that, and Congress didn't do anything about it. There was a court battle over it. One court decided it was legitimate, and one court decided it wasn't. So we're about to enact our own budget because the last court decision said that we were right. And last week, the House Oversight Committee put forth legislation to ban the referendum and to keep us from ever passing another one. And I mean, look, I'm not a big fan of this. I want to be a state. I want to have it all. I want to have the votes and representation of both houses. But this is just crazy not to let us spend our own tax money. This isn't money that comes from the federal government or anything. These are our property taxes and sales taxes and the $9 billion that Washingtonians pay in taxes every year. And the thing that was the craziest while I was there covering this hearing is some idiot from South Carolina, a congressman named Rick Mulvaney, said that his constituents had as much of a vested interest in the District of Columbia as the people that lived here. He didn't want to give up control because the city belonged as much to his constituents as the people that live here. In fact, this
get me
is
inside that pea brain. And how does he justify making that statement?
Well, you know, this is his quote. This is
yeah, but how can he even justify that?
I don't know. I don't think they care about justifying it. So,
in other words, I get that he has an opinion. I don't agree with it, but I'd really like to know how he justifies it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there were people that other members that were there that said, not only is that ridiculous, Jerry Connolly, who's from Virginia, said, well, don't be a cherry picker. Don't pick what you want to run in District of Columbia. Run everything. He said, Congressman, start going to zoning commission hearings. Start going to, you know, decide where the dog park should be. And, you know, don't pick what you want to control and leave the rest. You know, so it's just crazy, and they're fighting it, and it's coming to a vote on the floor this week. We expect it to pass in the House because it's solidly Republican, and this is a partisan issue. We don't know what will happen in the Senate. It's a little closer because there's you know, not as much division in the Senate. So we'll see.
So here, this is another thing. I understand the big picture because I've actually spoken about your cause to some of my local government officials, congressmen in particular. Mm-hmm. And they say, why should we give 750,000 people to senators? You know, I understand that kind of argument, if you will. But what I don't understand is, why can't you do with your funds as you choose to do with your funds? What's the argument, and why is that partisan?
Well, the argument that they made was that they had a responsibility and that it was a violation of the Constitution. And really what the Constitution says pretty clearly is that in Article 1, Section 8, it says that Congress shall have exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the District of Columbia. So basically it says Congress can do whatever it wants, but it never tells Congress what to do. So the fact that they have control of the budget, there's nowhere in the Constitution that gives them control of our budget. They just decided to do that, and they have the right to do it because the Constitution does give them the right to do whatever they want in the District of Columbia. But they could just as easily want to give us control of our own budget. And, of course, 40 years ago, they passed a thing called the Home Rule Act, which allows us to elect people in the district, and there were certain trade-offs made for an elected mayor and city council, and one of them was that the budget still had to be approved. So that was an argument too, that it was a violation of the Home Rule Act, which technically may be true, but those things can be easily amended.
We've made changes over time. Isn't that what the amendments are about?
Yeah, and the amendment process for the District of Columbia wouldn't have to be a constitutional amendment. It could be a simple act of Congress, because Congress controls everything in D.C. They can do whatever they want.
But, Michael, explain to me why it's partisan.
Oh, it's partisan because all the Republicans line up against us because we're solidly Democrat.
This one issue about you using your funds, how you choose to use your funds, doesn't sound partisan to me.
Well, it's only
partisan. It's not giving you statehood.
No, it's only partisan in the sense that Republicans stand against it because they want to retain control in every sense over the District of Columbia. So, for example, our legislation, you know, we have 149 co-sponsors, 150 co-sponsors, and they're all Democrats, not one Republican. So this was the thing on the House Oversight Committee. You had 16 Republicans and 12 Democrats. So when the issue came up, 16 Republicans voted for it, 12 Democrats voted against it. And then there was an amendment to overturn it, and 12 Democrats voted for that, and 16 Republicans voted against it. And that's what I mean by partisan. Not that it, you know, maybe favors one particular party over the other, especially over an issue like budget autonomy, but the opposition to it is drawn along party lines. And, you know, I've been in politics a long time, and I would, you know, I'm not, I wouldn't say that if the District of Columbia was all Republican, that the Democrats wouldn't put up the same kind of fight. I mean, unfortunately, this is the way the game's being played these days. There is no consensus, and it's a shame because there were some bills that would have expanded the rights of Washingtonians in the past that have had Republican support, but not in a while. And in fact, the Republican Party was pretty much ran the city after Lincoln, who we all know was a Republican, mm-hmm. and Washington was a very liberal place. Lots of the advances that were made for African Americans early on in Washington D.C. were made by Republicans, for example. And
along those lines, we talked about that when we were talking about our program on Emancipation Day. Yeah. The state of Wisconsin, the Republican women flew me there a couple years ago to talk to them about what Republicans have done historically for women, and it's astronomical, including the right to vote.
Oh, right. They were one of the first states that gave women the right to vote.
And the suffrage movement got legitimacy with the Republican Party. And then it's like, what happened?
Yeah.
Where did the uterus become part of that? You know?
Yeah. That's a whole thing that maybe we can get into a little bit after we talk about GMOs. But yeah, how the parties have been hijacked. And right now it's the Republican Party. But I remember the days when it was the Democratic Party. And it wasn't quite this extreme as I remember. But, you know, the liberal wing of the party, when Bill Clinton came along, we were all like, man, this guy's conservative. He's not a Democrat. He's a, you know, he went after things like welfare, which was the sacred cow of the liberals in the Democratic Party. You know, welfare to Democrats in those days was like the Second Amendment is to a lot of people.
Is that right?
Today. Oh, yeah. And when he thought about reforming it, they, you know, people called him all sorts of names. But the party needed to shift a little bit, obviously, more to the center, more to the right. And I think the Republicans have lost control right now, and they need
But that's what Trump is bringing out, because everybody has felt that way, is that we need to get more center. We're sick of being identified by right-wing Christians who are defining what the Republican Party is, because they don't speak my language. They don't represent me. I don't find anything about them. I don't have any affinity for them, and yet that's who people think of when they think of Republicans. And I think that's why Trump is resonating so much, because people are Republicans, but they're sick of being labeled that kind of Republican.
Yeah, I think that may very well be one of the reasons. I think another reason is that people are just dissatisfied. They're dissatisfied with the way things are going in this country. You know, I mean,
but ironically, Hillary is, you know, part and parcel with everything that's gone on.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that, but she is an establishment person, and so is Bernie. This is a perfect segue, because I am now the prettiest girl at the dance.
Are you a super delegate?
As a super delegate.
Woo-hoo!
The Bernie people are calling me. The Hillary Ooh. People are calling me. Bernie met with me. Hillary tried to meet with me yesterday, but it didn't work out. You know, everybody's
Michael.
Liking Senator Brown these days. Yeah, because
so
I'm one
it,
of
because
the
you
few
still
delegates.
Haven't committed.
Right,
because
I haven't committed. Right. And
last
so many
spoke,
others
you said
have.
You were waiting to hear what the people of the District of Columbia wanted.
Well, I think we pretty much know what the people of the District of Columbia want. But nonetheless, I don't feel, you know, I feel like we should let the process play out a little bit. Now, I may commit soon. I think, much like Trump has the Republican nomination, Hillary has the Democratic nomination. There's really no way that she can lose because of California. California has somewhere near 500 delegates. It's a proportional state, which means, you know, if you get 50% of the vote, you get approximately 250 delegates. So she's ahead in California.
Is she?
Yeah. She only needs 90 delegates. So it's not reasonable to believe that she wouldn't, even if she lost California by some miracle, she would still take enough of it to get way more than 90 delegates, and that puts her over the top of 2383, which is what she needs to be nominated. So it's pretty much in a fait accompli for her, although Bernie says he'll fight right to the end. And you know what? He'll walk into the convention with several thousand delegates.
Yes.
So that's way different than what the Republicans are going to, you know. I mean, Trump will be there, and who has very many? I mean, Cruz and Rubio and Kasich together don't have enough delegates to make a difference to Trump.
Well, and Republicans our primary in California is winner take all. So, plus he's the only one running. So, even I guess if they wrote somebody in, it wouldn't matter.
Right. Well, yeah, I don't think there are any winner take all primaries left for the Democrats. You know, we have them as well, but I think all the remaining ones are proportional. And next Tuesday, there's primaries in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, which strangely enough don't get represented, and they
remember Puerto Rico went for Rubio for Republican.
Right.
So they're having a second one now for Democrats?
Yes. And
okay.
But there aren't enough delegates. If she won both of them and won 100%, there aren't enough delegates to put her over the top. She'd still be like 10 delegates short before California. But California ends it all because it's California, New Jersey. There are three or four states, but California and New Jersey are both part of the sacred 11. You know, and this is another crazy thing about American politics. You can lose 39 states. You can lose in 39 states and still become the president of the United States because all you have to do is win the sacred 11 states. And, you know, California, Texas, Virginia, New Jersey, Illinois, Pennsylvania, all the New York, all the big pop, Florida,
the populace.
All the big, Indiana, Ohio. It looks like they both have them locked up.
As you know, California used to never count. They used to call us the ATM, that they would just come here to raise funds. But because by the first Tuesday or the second Tuesday in June, it's already been decided. So it's kind of for us here in this state, for us, our votes to actually matter is. I kind of misspoke. Republican delegates are winner take all in each district, and Democrats are proportional.
Yeah, and that may be proportional in each district too, so that it's not actually 50-50, you know, if you split the vote down the middle, but it's close to that.
Right. You know? Right. It's fun for us because I don't think in my lifetime, well, in recent memory, we've actually mattered nationally.
Well, you know,
probably know better than me.
It's funny that and another thing that you have, which has always been a problem, less of a problem now than it used to be, is being on the West Coast. That, you know, sometimes the vote in California, all the West Coast states went way down because they were announcing the winners.
Exactly.
Before the polls closed,
yep.
Right. So why are you going to go out and vote if you know the other guy's going to win to begin with?
Right.
D.C. very much feels that way because we give a ton of money to political candidates, and they never come to Washington. And, you know, the Democrats, we're so solidly Democrat. We're the most Democrat place in America, more Democrats, you know, per capita in the District of Columbia than anywhere. And we
really?
Go to the convention. Yes. Don't have any elected Republicans in the district. Never voted for a Republican for president. Never had a Republican mayor. Have no elected officials in the District of Columbia who are Republican. So when we win the Democratic primary, we go out, my wife and I go out and give donuts. We go around to the polls with a car full of donuts and just give donuts to all the poll workers. We don't even campaign on election day because no one has ever won the Democratic primary. Now, we've only been doing this for 40 years, but no one has ever won the Democratic primary in Washington, D.C. and then lost the general election. So the primary is what it's all about.
Now, you said, though, you had a ton of Republicans vote in your primary in D.C.
This year.
Yeah, you said you'd never seen that many.
We didn't even know there were that many Republicans in D.C.
and they were lined around the building for 3 or 4 hours?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Rubio won. It was, first of all, it was a nightmare for voters because the Republican Party, in their wildest imagination, didn't expect this many people, and I don't blame them, but they had like 2 voting machines, you know. They could have easily had 10 voting machines, but I'm sure they thought, well, what the hell do we, you know, two ought to cover it. Yeah, and so many more people showed up to vote than had ever voted in a primary that I ever heard of.
So, and was that because they didn't vote by mail? They chose to vote in person, and it surprised everybody, or what?
No, I think just an interest in the election, an interest in, you know, Donald Trump and what's going on. Rubio won by a landslide. Trump did not do well here. But, I think they were just more interested. And it was a different system for them because, for some reason, because we moved our primary back, our primary is the last primary. And they keep on changing these dates. I don't know why in the district. But California is the 7th of June, and it's California, New Jersey, and a bunch of other states. And then the last primary, June 14th, is only the District of Columbia.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well,
but you already had it. Republican, not Democrat.
Right. And lots of states do that. You know, some of them have it on the same day, some of them don't. So the Republicans couldn't have theirs on June 7th because it was too close to their convention. There's a law that it has to be a certain amount of time before the convention. And since the Republicans go first this time, and we're the Democrats, and we really don't give a damn about them, we scheduled the primary, so it interfered with their
convention.
Well, you know, I mean, it's true. You got to be honest, right? I mean,
like it, though. You're pulling the curtain aside. That's really sexy for us to hear you say these things.
The Democratic Party has their regular meetings in City Hall. There's got to be a violation of something, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, you and I can't get together and say, hey, Maria, what's up? Let's go have a meeting at City Hall.
Right.
You know, they'd want us to pay for the room, right? And to keep the lights on, unless it had something directly to do with the city. But yeah, we're no stranger to corruption, and that's coming from a guy from North New Jersey. And you know, one last thing while we're on the subject, we've started this new initiative to pass a referendum to take up to Capitol Hill. And, I mean, it's taken up all our time, 3 or 4 or 5 meetings a week, at night, public meetings, daytime meetings. But they're not putting any money into it. So I think it's, I got to tell you, I think it's foolish. They're not investing any money in getting the word out, or they have all these committees put together, but they have no budget. And I think it's just crazy. So I just want to pass that along. So shall we talk about GMOs?
Yeah, let's. And, you know, we're talking about this just for the listeners to know, because on Tuesday there was a study, a meta study actually, from the National Academies of Science, 388 pages, 2 years. They studied 900 studies and data covering 20 years since genetically modified organisms were first introduced. And the long and the short of it is that they say, there's no problem. There's no health issue. There's no problem with feeding it to livestock. There's, you know, no more anything in terms of autism and gluten and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm worried, Michael, to tell you the truth. They say there's no correlation between obesity or type 2 diabetes and the consumption of the GMOs. And what's scary to me is last year, 99% of our sugar beets were GMOs, 95% of our soybeans, 94% of our cotton, and 92% of the feed corn were all GMOs.
Well,
you cannot tell me that it doesn't have an effect on our health.
Well, I first of all, I, you know, my biggest problem with it, Maria, is that when God develops a crop, it takes a couple of million years of evolution, and it doesn't seem to me to make sense to let a couple of guys in a lab in New Jersey, you know, or Cleveland, do it in a few weeks. I mean, that's the thing that worries me most. It's just on the surface of it, it just sounds like a bad idea. And I got to tell you, I was not only amazed at the study that you quoted, but the Washington Post, which is a pretty liberal newspaper, wrote an editorial yesterday in support of all on Friday.
Defending GMOs?
Yeah.
Saying really?
That, yeah. This is the title of the editorial is Frankenfoods They're Not. Fears about really? Genetically engineered crops are overblown.
Yikes.
Well, first of all, everybody, the Europeans don't do this.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's such so obvious to everybody, you know, that's another problem I have. Why isn't the whole world embrace this? And, you know, I want to feed the world. We all do, right? But the research that I'm reading says that this really doesn't increase yields. Even their own study, even the study you quoted, which says it's not doing any harm, also says it's not increasing yields. So if it's not, what the hell are we doing it for? You know,
it's mostly weed abatement, which I don't understand why that's an issue, because weeds can coexist with crops.
Right.
It doesn't stop the corn from getting sunlight. The corn shoots up above the weeds. So if it isn't producing yield, then so do we care that there are weeds next to our corn when we eat it? No. Does the farmer care that there are weeds? That's what I don't understand. It's all about weed abatement.
Well, and you know what? I mean, look, I ran my own business for 25 years, and I've got no I have no reason to want to go out and bash business, but profit motive is just an overwhelming force when you're in business. So when it comes to things that could disrupt the entire ecosystem, I really have a problem leaving it in the hands of business, you know, because there's such pressure for them to make profit. Hey, if I could genetically modify a crop that was resistant to something, and you and I both grew corn, would I then unleash something that would kill off your crops, and which my crops are resistant to? You know what I mean? The whole politics of it worries me too.
Here's the thing, like you're saying, though, about profit, because let's really call a spade a spade. We're really talking about Roundup and Monsanto, basically, which people like to pussyfoot around for whatever reason. But I made an attempt, because I've interviewed the director and the writer. It's called GMO OMG, and it was this dad on a quest to find out for his sons, the on behalf of this next generation, just what's this all about. And when he showed up unannounced to Monsanto to interview the executives, they forbade him from entering the building. They already knew who he was and what he wanted to get. And he wasn't – how was he on their radar? He's just like some guy, some dude that was just trying to do a documentary on it. But one thing that has come out, Michael, since the study was published on Tuesday is – and they're not mentioning this – that there's a conflict of interest among the scientists, because over half of the scientists have worked on the development or the promotion of GMOs or have industry ties.
Well, I mean, you know, are these
Do you not
the
think that's
scientists?
Tainted?
Oh, absolutely.
Hello?
And weren't these guys around in the 1940s and 50s telling us that smoking wasn't bad for us?
Right.
You know, I read an article, and I just thought this was so interesting years ago, and this was to your point, that Philip Morris hired a scientist to develop how to make a less dangerous cigarette. And he invented it. He invented a cigarette that was safer. And what it was, basically, is a low-tar cigarette that was high in nicotine. He said the idea of low-tar, low-nicotine cigarettes is a bad idea because people smoke to get nicotine. And nicotine, unless it's in its pure form, is not any more harmful than caffeine. So he made this high-nicotine, low tar cigarette that would give you the jolt you were looking for with less tar. And they canceled the project, and they shredded all the results because they didn't want to admit that the stuff that they had been selling was bad. So they right. didn't want to invent something that was better. And you know, that's the profit. That's the profit motive.
I'll never forget the feature film with the actor whose name escapes me, but I can see his face
Bill,
perfectly.
What's his name?
They called it, I want to say Kevin Costner, but not Kevin Costner. But anyway, they called it a nicotine delivery device. They didn't even refer to it as a cigarette.
Right. Thank you for not smoking. It was, I can't remember the guy's name either, Bill something, but I mean, and that was your job as lobbyists, right? To get the thing over, but the science, they had plenty of science behind it. And look at how much things have changed. You know, when I was in college, I had a friend whose job it was to work in a grocery store, Safeway store, and sweep up the cigarette butts off the floor. Now imagine lighting up in the middle of a Safeway today. You'd probably be beaten and drug out of the store by the people that shop there. They wouldn't
younger listeners do not recall, but I do, when you could smoke on planes, and it was the back of the plane that the smokers
were
seated.
Well, that's one of the more brilliant. That was one of the more brilliant moves, right? Because we didn't know about secondhand smoke. Right. But I could be sitting next to you, and on your side of the plane was no smoking, and I could be smoking. Yeah, in that contained little space. Oh, yeah, smoking everywhere.
So
we used to smoke in class in college. But
a sinister little story about this whole issue about genetically modified foods. There was a couple that I knew that the man was really active in being aggressive about making better choices with what we consume. And he turned me on to this book. It's called Death by Supermarket. And it's written by a woman who's a science writer. And it talks about, she promotes unhomogenized milk, that's better for us, and that the whole milk dairy board, they're homogenizing it for no damn reason, et cetera. So she mentioned Monsanto, Agent Orange, and soybeans. And so I thought, you know what, I'm gonna get this book. So I go on to Barnes & Noble and the other bookstore online. It's out of print and on back order. So then I click through, and I finally find a way to buy the book. So I buy the book, and then I get an email that says it's on back order. They're sorry, but they had already charged my credit card. So I just figured, oh, well, they'll give me a credit. Well, fast forward to – I ordered the hardback because I have a library, and I only put hardback books in it. Once I read them, that's where I keep them. Comes to my door the book that I ordered in paperback from the United Kingdom. Apparently, you can't get it in the United States because it lampoons some of these sacred cows, that they've made it unable for us to purchase it. So my book that I bought from a little bookstore in Northern California, which was, I paid for the hardback and I got the paperback, came from the UK. So you want to talk about Machiavellian.
Well, and you know what? The fact that you say Agent Orange, you know, they told us Agent Orange was safe. They told us PCBs were safe, polychloride biphenyls, which take, I don't know how long they take to break down in the environment, but it's like tens of thousands of years. DDT was another thing that was supposed to be safe for us. Thalidomide. I mean, we could go on and on and on about things that have been well tested. And how many of us turn on the TV and hear that commercial? Have you taken this drug or that drug and had these side effects? Call the law firm of Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe, and you know, and we'll get you a big settlement. Xarelto. I mean, we know the names of all of them. They've been out. So it really shocked me, not only to study, but then to read the editorial in the Washington Post in support of it. And, you know, again, one of my big concerns is the environment, because if they're more resistant to herbicides, mm-hmm. we're going to use more herbicides.
Right.
And, right? Kill off right. the bug.
And that's the whole point.
Right. And look at DDT. Look at what it did.
Well, they say, now it doesn't say anything about that in the study. All it mentions is that it hasn't affected the population of monarch butterflies, according to this report. But you know, we've got a bee crisis, not only in the United States, but in Europe, too. And Europe has said that GMOs are also part of that problem.
Right. Because and of the pollinization. The
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard everything from cell phone towers to mm-hmm. they don't know what it is. And yeah, with, you know, there's a, I was reading an article about that where the real money in bees, I always thought it was honey. They had beekeeping at the University of Maryland. I'll never forget the first day of class, the first day I registered, somebody said to me, well, if you can't do science, take beekeeping. If you can get through the course, if you can get to the course without getting stung too much, you'll get a C. So anyway, but the big money is putting them in tractor trailers and taking them out and letting them go in farmers' yes. fields because yes. you need them for pollination.
Can you imagine? So what do we do when
we kill off all the bees?
We have to truck bees to yeah. pollinate our crops. There's something wrong.
Yeah.
That's just wrong. Now, I just had house guests, and they were asking me what our topic was going to be, and I told them this. And one of them got on his big high horse and said that the big problem is meat consumption and raising forests so that we can have more grain grow to feed them and or more land for the cows to graze on and the methane gas that they emit and, you know, the carbon footprint that it's creating and stuff like that. He said, if you want to really talk about something that's really affecting the world, it's our meat consumption. And I was like, okay, we can go there, but meat is a part of, you know, they say if you buy 10% organic, you're actually helping the organic cause. Because he said we should reduce our consumption by 50% of beef. I said that's never going to happen. But GMOs we have control over.
Right.
I mean, that's made, like you said, in the lab. And he said, we've been doing genetically modified for centuries. And I said, like what? And he said, well, Tangellos, for example. I said, that was grafted in the fields, not in a lab. You know, yeah. you have broccolini, which is broccoli and asparagus, I guess, that's a cross.
Yeah.
That's done in Mother Nature. Now, yes, it's modifying it, but not in a science, you know, with a white coat and a microscope.
Yeah, I don't think you can compare what Washington Carver did with what they're talking about today. I mean, certainly, you know, plant splicing and that stuff, and that occurs in nature. You know, right. I remember taking an environmental science course, and one of the projects was that we had to go out into the woods and find hybrids. So we had to find, for example, leaves. We had to collect leaves that had the characteristics of both the classic oak leaf and a classic maple leaf.
And had somehow blended?
Yeah, it somehow, you know, blended through the, and there are lots of examples of it. I don't know that we found very many because we were, you know, but letting a bunch of teenagers loose in the woods is not necessarily conducive to getting them to
scientific
study,
pursuits.
But, yeah.
Well, what about a four-leaf clover? Isn't that kind of an anomaly?
Yeah, I would think. And you know, and we have a lot of those, you know that God didn't create the avocado. No offense to the people of California, but he wouldn't have made anything with a seed that big. You know, unless he said, gee, we need something for fourth grade science projects. Let's make something that big. But, you know, there are a lot of hybrid things and but you're right. They happen through nature, and you know, and even that causes us problems, doesn't it? I mean,
it does.
The crops change, and we have to change insecticides, and we have to do, other things because of what nature's done. I covered probably one of the great experiences of my life legislatively was I covered PL 480, which is the farm bill, back when I was in college, which is still in effect today. And I remember these guys. I remember these guys from Cargill Grain, and they used to bring in some small farmer from Tennessee who had 300 acres, 500 acre family farm, and he would talk about farm subsidies and other things that affected them. But then you'd read about them, and you'd read that they were so massive that 75% of all the grain in America went through them, that they weren't little farmers. They were gigantic corporate farmers, but they put this face on everything that, you know, that this was all about little struggling farmers. And I remember, I just thought, man, these guys, and what do they know about agriculture in their $3,000 suits and their, you know, it was all about money. And well, so it scares me.
Along those lines, I'd like to give our listeners a takeaway, is that there's an organization called foodandwaterwatch.org, and they're on the tails of this. And they actually said that they petitioned, it's called the National Research Council, to say, by the way, millions of dollars in donations come into your organization from biotech companies like Monsanto, and they document the one-sided panels of the scientists that they use to carry out their GMO studies. So because of this, they're not accepting it lying down. This group has agreed to do another study that they're going to start out, and it's supposed to be, quote, balanced this time around. So based on what I've read on the aftermaths of who these folks are and what they concluded, I'm not going to take it as evidence. It's tainted. It stinks, as far as I can tell. So I still say GMOs are bad.
Yeah, and I say, you know, when you're talking about something in the environment that can have such a dramatic impact, I mean, God forbid we create a strain that kills everything somehow in a laboratory. When you're talking about stuff like that, I think you always have to err on the side of caution. And if it's not increasing yields and it's not feeding more people, why do it?
And
why
you're adding drugs, if you will, for no personal takeaway gain.
Yeah.
I mean, like we said, because it's all about weeds, well, who the hell cares? So if and like you said, if it doesn't affect yield, then what's the point? We're adding something that's unnecessary. And I'm just, you know, to me, less is better. That's why I try and do whenever possible free range, hormone free, you know, organic. I don't want chickens in coops with their beaks and their toes cut off so that we can get more in a cage because it takes less space, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I just think we have to be compassionate. I'm not saying I'm a meat eater. I'm a flesh eater. So I'm not saying that. I'm just saying if that's what we're, if those are the choices we're going to make, let's make intelligent, compassionate ones.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that, you know, this is just, even if the study is correct, I think this is a slippery slope and that we got to be more careful dealing with it than we have been. And we can't rely on the information that we're, I agree with you there too. We can't rely on information that we're getting from these people.
In fairness to Michael, it isn't just about weeds. It's about insects too. So they're insect resistant also.
Yeah.
But if it's not increasing yield per your original comment, then what's the point?
Right. Well, and we can't make super insects, can we? Look at Zika virus and all the other things we're dealing with. What if you make something that you can't kill?
Right.
You know, that carries, you know, is like a tsetse fly or something else. I mean, it's just crazy. Well, I'm finding this very hard to believe, but we're out of time.
You're kidding.
No, it's 7:50. It's almost 7:55. And on behalf of Maria Sanchez, Michael Brown, and all the meat eaters of the world, we're going to take you out with a song by Jimmy Buffett.
Well, and don't forget soybeans and beets.
soybeans and beets, whatever the hell that means. What do you mean?
they're all GMOs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that has nothing to do with the burger.
And I'm all about the burger.
And I love your choice of song. Thank you, Michael. Have a great week. Good luck
this
week.
See you next week.
Huh?
Thank you.
Sir.
You too.
Okay.
All right, America. Come back next week.
Yes,
here's
please.
Jimmy Buffett.
Thank you.
Cheeseburgers in paradise! Try to admit my carnivorous habit. Made it nearly 70 days. Losing weight without speed eating sunflower seeds. Drinking lots of carrots and soaking up a rain. Not zucchini, fettuccine, bulgur wheat, but a big warm bun and a huge hummy. Cheeseburger in paradise. Came on earth with an onion slice. Not too particular, not too precise. I'm just a cheeseburger in paradise. Heard about the old-time sailor man. The same thing again and again. Warm beer and bread, they say can raise the dead. Reminds me of a menu at a Holiday Inn. Time change for sailors these days. I'm in port, I get what I need. Not Havanas or bananas and daiquiri, but that American creation, oh, it's not you. Cheeseburger is paradise.
Give the people their right to vote.